following program contains adult subject matter and adult language. I have been told that I must inform you that it contains spoilers. It is a non-profit broadcast, and no copyright infringement is intended. Now thank you, and enter if you dare.
Welcome back to Bonding Agents, the father and son Spy-Fi podcast. I'm Diablo Frank, and with me is...
Old dude.
And we've just finished watching an episode of Avengers 63. Before we get into that, I have virtually no familiarity with the Avengers. I'm not actually even that big of a British television guy. By my reckoning, you're a bit of an Anglophile. How did you get into watching Brit television?
The Avengers was on American TV. Most of it was the Emma Peel. But it was on American TV. Jogging my memory, because it has been a while. It seems to me that they tried to run the ones with Honored Blackman, but it didn't go over. And you just watched one, and you could probably see why. It's not really something I think most Americans could understand. In 63, the shows that we were watching were so different. With this, the language, the delivery, the scores that are played, and the way that they cut from scene to scene, for most Americans, wouldn't be able to grasp it. The British invasion may have begun, but, you know, America had to catch up to it, catch up to the humor of it. Of course, what we were just watching didn't have a lot of humor in it. The title of the show was The Undertakers, which was a theme throughout the Avengers. In fact, in this one here, there's a very old Bentley's hearse, which was used for one of the most famous of the Mrs. Peel shows much, much later that was completely different than this. The shows could be repetitious, but it would be long periods of time. There are a couple of shows, several of them, in fact, that took place in 63 and 64 that came back in 67 and 68 with Mrs. Peel, where they virtually did the exact same show, just with a different woman as Steed's partner. They often like to use what I guess you would call macabre things, like undertakers and hearses and all kinds of things in the show. This is something that happened ever so often all the way through the show. And it was always kind of a juggling game where you're trying to follow. It's like the shell game. Something goes in the coffin, something else comes out of the coffin. But I really think that for Americans at that time, it didn't work. But the ones with Emma Peel, that was a regular evening show. We used to watch it with my mother. Of course, my mother was anything British, and I'm sure she had the hots for Steve. I watched it because I just thought it was too cool. Of course, anything British was cool.
So was this like the first British television show that you got to watch with any kind of regularity then?
Yeah. You know, up until then, Disney was doing all these different movies, things like Mary Poppins and stuff like that.
Bedknobs and Broomsticks, I imagine.
Yeah, that was Angela Lansbury, wasn't it? Yeah, see, we'd go to the movies and we'd see that. And that was about as close to prep as I could say we got. My mother did take us to the drive-ins. It was something we'd do maybe once a month or something. And so we saw Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Mary Poppins, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Also, later on, you know, shows like Hayley Mills was in it, like The Trouble with Angels and all that kind of stuff. We'd go and we'd see those movies. As far as British TV, we lived in Tennessee during a lot of that. They didn't have public TV there. Houston was about the only public TV station, I think, for quite a while.
In the South?
No, Channel 8 KUK, if you look it up, you'll find out that it was the first public broadcasting company anywhere in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, Houston was the first for something.
Why were we the first, do you think?
Probably just because we had a college here. There's a history, and they like to talk about it. I'm sure it's all over a website, but I knew it at the time. It was a one-town deal. And then other big cities later on caught up to it. There was a TV show called Ketterick. It was made for kids. And this middle-aged woman dressed up as a black cat, and she was the host of the show. It was a real famous thing. It went on for quite a while.
Well, what all did she host? Like cartoons and stuff? Like Bozo the Clown kind of stuff?
I don't remember that. I think there was some little, but mostly it was like skits.
Okay.
She dressed as a black cat, and she swang on a swing. I remember that. We always watched Ketterick when we were down here in the summer. And to tell you the truth, I don't remember that much about the early PBS shows. I just remember there was no commercials on them. If I remember right, they had very few shows and their broadcast time was very limited. The first remembrance of them having things like the Avengers was probably when it was the Avengers. And that was like in the 70s or something, you know. For a long time there, that was the only place you were going to see it was on PBS. But back in the 60s when they were on, they were a regular. And you can get all that off the internet. I know it's out there. But they were a regular
broadcast.
Syndicated, yeah, it was a syndicated show on network TV.
You see, for me, living with my mother, we did not watch very much high-minded television. As a kid, probably the only British thing I watched as a very young kid was probably the Benny Hill Show, which used to run, I think, at 10 o'clock on Channel 39. Mm-hmm. I think it ran against the news, and if we could avoid watching anything that might be enriching, then we would. So we tended to watch Benny Hill instead of, you know, anything educational. Did you ever watch Benny Hill?
Yeah, and I can't remember if it was on UHF or cable. I remember that the new Avengers I saw on A&E.
The new Avengers I would catch every now and again because they would play it late at night on CBS. But I didn't watch it. I'd be flipping through the channels and I would see the new Avengers. Being a kid, I thought of the comic book characters. And mm-hmm. I was like, my first education in things like Trademark, I didn't understand how you could have the Mighty Avengers in the comic books and then have these British people on television. I don't think this is for me. I never watched it with any kind of regularity. I would just catch it while I'd be flipping through the channels. And like I said, it was specifically the new Avengers, which I imagine was a slightly different animal than the old TV shows?
Slightly, but not much. When we get to those, you'll see it's not that much different.
What about Benny Hill, though?
Well, I mean, I can remember watching Benny Hill, but not as a child. I mean, you know, I was a grown man. And like I said, I can't remember if I saw it on UHF or if it was on cable.
Well, but I mean, people may not even know what Benny Hill is.
Well, he's a goofball comedian that does skits.
A lot of raunchy stuff. Basically, much of the show was centered around what we now call sexual harassment. This chubby, dopey Englishman trying to feel up pretty young ladies.
Yeah, that was a part of the... If you're in tune with British humor and the little skinny man,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you watch the Beatles movies...
Was he the mixer? Was he John Lennon's uncle?
But I'm telling you that was a staple of British humor for a while, is to have some little old man, and he was usually a little skinny man.
Yeah, and in the case of Benny Hill, he didn't talk, right? He was mute?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And what is it? Is it A Hard Day's Night?
Yeah.
Yeah, A Hard Day's Night, he's a very clean...
He's very clean.
He's very clean.
Yeah. I always think of him as the mixer because he's the guy who constantly intentionally causes trouble, sets people against one another, manipulates people just for his own amusement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a manipulator in that. I think it's in Magical Mystery Tour. They also have a similar character.
The reputation precedes it, so I never did make it to Magical Mystery Tour. I stopped watching Beatles stuff after Help.
You know.
I loved Help, though. Help was great fun.
Right, and Help was the only Beatle movie I had seen until I was an adult. I caught Mystery Tour and Hard Day's Night, I think, at showings at Huffines Pavilion as fundraisers. I remember Mystery Tour, they advertised as a laser show 3D. I can't remember the exact terminology they used. And what it was is they had these three panels in the center. It was basically you were viewing it in the round. Because you could be anywhere around these. It was a triangle of patterns. And it was projected on each one all at the same time. I think they were using a projector either from the top or the bottom or whatever, but it was more than just watchable. I remember being disappointed that it wasn't like 3D, or they might have been using a laser, because all you saw was coming up and the panels weren't really all that big, because at first I thought they were showing it from one end of the room. It was just passing through the other panels, and most of my time watching it was trying to figure out where the light was coming from, yes.
And then as far as other British TV too, you watched Monty Python?
Oh, I'm a big Monty Python fan. That was, yeah, of course, that was late night in the 70s. And so you'd watch Saturday Night Live, and then you'd watch Monty Python. Again, that goes to show American sensibilities, even that close to the 80s, it still had to be very late. And they did censor it. A lot of that stuff they didn't show. The guy's butt was actually showing, you didn't see it.
Yeah, I watched a little Monty Python, but it was really over my head as a kid. I've seen the movies and some of the episodes and skits since then. I appreciate it. But I'd never embraced it the way a lot of other people did, because I was a little too young while it was still being shown with regularity on PBS. And then by the time I was old enough, it wasn't really around anymore. So sadly, I tended to embrace Are You Being Served? Because that was another one that would show it around 10:30, around the same time as the news. And it was on regularly at a time when I was old enough to appreciate all the sexual innuendo. Kind of white trash the way I grew up. I can relate to the humor in Are You Being Served a lot better than Monty Python. For those who don't know, Are You Being Served is a show based in a department store, mostly in the 70s, as I recall, and just the oddball characters and that populated it. There was the closeted gay guy, so of course there's a lot of innuendo around him. There was the blue-haired or various other colored-haired ladies who had a cat that was always referred to as her pussy, so of course there was a bunch of variations on that. There was sort of the sarcastic cad. There was the uptight floor manager. There was the young naive girl that would all.
He was the uptight, pretentious.
Yeah, the colonel. The captain.
Yeah, they called him the captain, but yeah. he was actually I think a corporal.
Yeah, a doddering old man that ran the store, that owned the store, and then another funny looking fellow with big ears that was that actual manager
who was actually the writer and producer and the real brains behind it all. Yeah.
Well, and his bits were usually pretty good, too, because he was the one who was having to be he was really the only reasonable person on the show for the most part. He was the one guy who was trying to navigate all these disparate personalities.
But yeah.
I dug that. And then when I got a little bit older, there was a couple that I used to work for, and we would all get drunk on vodka and watch Blackadder at around that same time on PBS.
And I've got a friend that just loves him. Okay.
Rowan Atkinson?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people here in the States, they only know him from Mr. Bean, and they can't understand that he played another character that was literally a 180-degree turn, who was the pompous, sardonic person amongst a bunch of morons trying to navigate very deadly, dangerous politics in a variety of different time periods. You know, it was a period piece that spanned from medieval times through the First World War.
Yeah, and I'm just not a fan of the actor. I watched the Blackadder off and on, and I watched Mr. Bean every once in a while. I think both of them were on cable.
If I remember correctly, whenever I did watch Mr. Bean, they would do like little half-hour specials on him on, I think, HBO. And I'd catch it every now and again.
Yeah, well, I, too, lived in an apartment complex where that was part of the gig. You got the basic cable for free.
Part of the rent, yeah.
Yeah, and it was my only standing stint with cable. And I watched HBO, A&E, and the Discovery Channel. So I missed a lot of broadcast TV during, because I was just not interested. I'm not a big fan of his. In fact, I was in a resale shop recently and found one of his movies. And I bought it to take to my friend because she just loves him. It doesn't matter what he does, she loves it. But
When me and Paquita were in London, we had a little suite we were staying in. It just so happened they were running a Blackadder documentary retrospective that during that time period, and it was like, perfect, this is exactly what I want to see while I'm here.
Some people, all that stuff, like your grandmother, if it's British, it's great. There's some stuff that I can do without. Keeping Up Appearances. I can't stand that show. There's another show that she does that took place later on where she's like a amateur detective. I like that. So it's not her. It's that character. I just don't like that character. And I don't know what it is about the other actor, but it seems to me it's monotonous. The characters he does, doesn't matter if they're all that much different. They're monotonous characters to me. But again, it's taste. I do a lot of reviews on things, products. I never, ever review books or music or movies. So these discussions that we have about these things, I don't feel is being a movie critic, because I'm not criticizing any of it. We're just discussing it. And really, if there's any criticism, it would be coming from you.
Yeah, I'm not quite as reserved about my opinions on subjective things.
I believe entertainment is a matter of taste. And just because one person likes it and another person doesn't mean that either one of them are correct or incorrect. If it entertains you, it's good entertainment. Plain and simple. You can't please everybody all of the time. It's just not going to happen. So I never do reviews on that sort of stuff, because sometimes I read them. And man, most of those reviewers are so full of themselves. I'll bet you none of them have the education to even, you know, if you're going to criticize something, you should have some knowledge of the subject.
Well, it's just like, Justice League, at the time of this recording, Justice League came out very recently. And I was reading the National Review, Armand Wright, White did that. And Armand White's already kind of a known crank. He's a guy who hates things that people love things people hate. I don't do that on purpose. I sometimes think that he does it because some of his opinions are so out there that it's like, you're trolling us, right? You don't actually believe this, you know? People sometimes think that I do that. And I'll sometimes take a stand just for dramatic purposes. But typically that's more a matter of maybe selling an opinion strong, more that I have more strongly than I actually feel it. It's not a situation where I'm actually bullshitting on an opinion. But when I'm reading this guy's Justice League review, Justice League, fun movie, it's crap though. It's just a fucking mess of bad edits and reshoots. And this guy's waxing rhapsodic, and he's invoking Zack Snyder's name with, you know, great artists of history and everything else. It's like, dude, there's no way any of us are buying this. You're full of shit. Anytime somebody kind of comes at me with some Zack Snyder stuff about, you know, trying to say it's so deep, there's so much subtext, like, get the fuck out of my face. You're full of shit. Where the fuck was I going with all that shit? I get that a lot from some of these reviewers where they speak so definitively about something, so passionately about something, and it's like, either you're an idiot or you're full of shit, because there's no way you could feel that strongly and come at it from a place of knowledge about something that's so shitty, or vice versa, that you rip apart something that's so good, that's so objectively high quality, to minimize it so much without having some sort of an agenda behind it. So I see where you're coming from there.
Well,
I try not to be that person, but I see where you're coming from there.
I read newspapers until I didn't live in Houston. We really don't have what I would call newspapers out here. And the truth is, if I read a bad review about a movie in a genre that I liked, I knew that was the movie I wanted to see.
I'll definitely take an interesting failure over a competent mediocrity, you know?
Well, it's... I mean, you could say the same thing about Broadway shows. I mean, a good example of that would be Hair. Man, there were critics that wanted to destroy Hair. You know, they go, this isn't the... I mean, I can remember, they can't possibly think this is theater. I remember reading that in a review once. It's because they just didn't understand it. And at the
time, a lot of times you've got people who so firmly believe in what something is supposed to be that when they're confronting with something that's legitimately innovative, that's far outside of the narrow scope of what they believe an art form is supposed to be or genre is supposed to be or what have you, they just react violently against it.
You have to look at, that's another example, is you have to look at it in the time that it came out. The opening scene in Hair is all the lights come down. You can't see anything. It's pitch. And then when it starts coming up, the cast is walking down the aisles between the guests, the viewers, the audience itself. And, you know, they're naked and, you know, doing things like dragging a woman by her hair and stuff and going towards the stage. You know, I think it was 1967. Believe me, America was not prepared for it. And it was meant as shock and awe, you know? And with British TV, like Monty Python and Benny Hill, that was shock and awe TV to an audience that understood the humor. See, American humor and British humor are different. Now, you know, Americans have come a long way, but sometimes they still don't get it, you know, because of the blunt dryness of British humor. And there must be something twisted in me because I always did. I mean, I just got it right from get-go. Mm-hmm. And some things that they think is funny, I don't think it's funny.
Well, again, you talk about keeping up appearances and you have no use for class.
That's the other thing. See, I knew people. Your grandmother is kind of like her.
Yeah, which probably explains part of your issue with the show.
No, you have pretentious people that want to be above their station. Now, I'm the kind of person, I don't view stations, and I don't care anything about royalty. It means nothing to me. I think Queen Elizabeth, I kind of feel sorry for her. But at the same time, she's done a number of things during my lifetime, kind of pissed me off. But then again, she is just a symbol, a highly paid symbol. I don't want to be around it because I don't want to pretend that I in any way honor it, you know, because I don't. I mean, it's like our president today. I want to puke just looking at that slime. So I don't want to go to some function where he's going to be there. Even when I like a president, I just don't want to be subservient, period.
Yeah.
I've worked around wealthy, highly intelligent, powerful people, I would address them in a respectful manner. But I was never a butt kisser. You know, it just wasn't my style. And sometimes it would piss them off, and sometimes they appreciated it because they hated getting their butt kissed. But I always saw it. If I do my job, you need to respect that, too. I don't understand people's all at royalty and that kind of, and the Brits, it's really strange. They continue this tradition and they all seem to be into it, but at the same time, they're the best ones at making fun of it too.
Getting back to the Avengers though.
Okay.
I've had very little exposure to the Avengers to this day. They did some comic books, and again, they couldn't call it Avengers because they were actually on the territory of the Mighty Avengers. They would call it Steve and Mrs. Peel, I think. And it was too British for me. It didn't really do anything for me. I've read about them. I've encountered some of those actors in different places. I just know it's a spy kind of show. And then we just watched an episode, The Undertakers. I don't know who these characters are, but they're talking to each other in a very familiar way. And it seems like there's a status change because John Steed, who's this British fellow with a, what is that? The
bowler hat.
And a nice suit. He walks around that umbrella. So he's like your classical English gentleman. And he's with a woman who is dressed in a, she's stylish, but she's also, you can tell that she's somebody who's capable, who's got like a physical quality to her. And over the course of their conversation, she's working on a giant sniper rifle, putting that together. And
well, she starts with a, I don't know if it was a Beretta or a Walter PPK, because they both made models that flipped up like that. But, you know, they were a little, it was a little 380 pocket gun. And then she goes to an assault rifle. Right. Yeah.
While she's doing that, Steed is telling her about how he's going to go to the United States. He'll be gone for a while. He's going to be working with a noted scientist, bringing a bunch of stuff from his pantry to drop off at her place that he'd been meaning to unload for a while. And
well, I see. There you go. That would have been something that Americans would not have understood. You know, a lot of people don't realize that things like, simple things like food were still kind of in short supply because of World War II.
Yeah, they still had elements of rationing even into the 60s, 15 years after the end of the war.
Right. So what he was doing was a commonsensical, neighborly thing to do.
But the whole time he's fishing for some interest on her part, concerned about him being gone for a long period of time, fishing for any sort of a romantic spark, and she's completely dismissive of him. Reminds him to make sure to leave, put a stamp on the postcard so that it got to her this time, because apparently he'd gone away at previous times and not kept contact with her.
Well, with his partners, he was generally truthful, but the character of Steed was a liar.
Okay.
So
well, this is the thing that I don't get, because it just starts right in the middle of everything. And, you know, I thought that this was the first episode of Avengers 63, and I made a point I wanted to kind of go into this virginal to a large degree as much as I could. Because I do have to sit and point out, too, I did watch the movie that came out 15 years ago or whatever it was with Ralph Fiennes and Uma Thurman, mostly because I was interested in seeing Uma Thurman.
Which came,
running around in vinyl.
A lot of the stuff came directly out of the Avengers TV series.
Yeah, but as a person who wasn't schooled in that, it just seemed kind of weird and goofy, and especially American audiences.
I truly appreciated it. Now, yeah. You know, I didn't think that I would like those actors and those characters, but I have to admit that I did. Like you said, you are not familiar with the Avengers. You're not a fan of the Avengers. I'm telling you that I felt, as a fan, that it caught the spirit of the Avengers. I mean, they took elements from actual Avengers shows and put them in there. And as they came, and of course they were better because the photography was better. Some of those were black and white shows, and here it is in vivid color. It's on a big screen. I didn't see it in the movie theater, but I got a 60-inch TV. I found no fault in that movie, and I went into it thinking that I would. But on the other hand, you got to remember, in these early ones, you just watched one of the early ones with Honor Blackman.
You say one of the early ones, too. It's like, I thought we were going to watch the first episode of the Avengers, but my understanding now is this isn't the first Avengers.
What do you mean? Did you check something on the internet?
No. Yeah, well, I mean,
huh?
What do you know about that?
What do you mean, what do I know about it?
I mean, was that the first episode of the Avengers?
As far as I know, it was. If you noticed, it is kind of disorganized. Mm-hmm. Like they're trying to find
familiarity.
Well, I don't know. You know, usually show, and especially back in those days when, I mean, you know, when they're doing that, it's basically a stage production. And, of course, on a 60-inch, if you're paying attention to the background and stuff, when a brick wall moves, something's not right.
Well, because I like I said, I wanted to go in there as virginal as possible, but because I could tell that the show wasn't exactly inviting me as a new viewer to watch it, giving me the details of who these people are or why they're doing what they're doing, I did do a little tiny bit of research just to check it out. And there were two whole seasons before this one. The show actually started in 1961.
Right, and the reason I remember the reason why I didn't care anything about those is because even the ones on DVD were so, you couldn't hardly see anything because the video was that bad.
Yeah, and then like Doctor Who, they had the same issue where they shot it on videotape and then they reused the videotape, so most of the first season doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Or exists in like, at the very first episode, they have like 20 minutes of audio only, and I think they've only got like a couple or three complete episodes still available to be seen, that and that's available on DVD.
Okay, well, it may have been the first one that they tried to show on American TV. I'm pretty sure I am right about that.
It may well be. Like I said, I didn't do a lot of research. All I saw was that apparently the show originally started a totally different character, a doctor, and that Steed was introduced later on as his partner. And then over time, Steed's role grew, and then there was a strike, and the doctor actor never came back, and then Steed took over the show. And then eventually started the thing where he has female partners that work with him. And that's how you end up with Honor Blackman. But Honor Blackman wasn't even the first one of his female partners, from what I understand.
No.
Apparently in the early episodes, he was more of a rough and tumble type. He ran around like a trench coat. He was more like a man of action. And
no, I've seen some of those. That's why I know the video is so bad.
Mm-hmm.
It also goes to show it took them a long time to get that. It's really funny when you see those interviews, and you, I've seen interviews of the people that was with the Avengers. The BBC is a weird kind of network, but in a way, they're not so different than ours. You get some executives that don't see a use for the show. There's been a lot of Doctor Who interviews where they talk about the politics of the BBC. Thing starts and it stops and they change characters. All kinds of silly stuff. None of that is surprising to me. You know, I want to be able to watch because I am interested in that kind of stuff. A friend of mine had earlier copies of them and I tried to watch them. There was a PBS special where they were kind of like a retrospective on it, and I watched that. You couldn't hardly see any of that. I've got some of them original Doctor Who's. You're straining to see any kind of detail, but in a lot part of it, all you can see is Doctor Who's head because he was so white and white-headed. It's the only thing left you can see. Everything else is just black.
Well, I understand with Doctor Who, they're actually filming cartoons, like animated reproductions of the shows based on the audio that they found. But in the case of these Avengers episodes that are completely lost, they're doing, I think, BBC-style radio programs where they're restaging from the scripts.
That's fine. But, I mean, that's not something that, I mean, you know, I when I'm interested in something like that, I kind of want the stuff.
The real stuff.
Yeah. Tell you the truth, the original Doctor Who, he was a grandfather. Lived with his granddaughter. Because after all, Doctor Who was a child show. But in the 70s, when I'm sitting there watching it on PBS on the weekends, because it only came on later at night on the weekends on PBS, I thought that was the wildest psychedelic thing I'd seen. I mean, I really was, I don't know, I guess you would call me snobbish about it. I really thought it was a highbrow thing that I learned. It's a Saturday morning kids show. But instead of feeling stupid, I just thought it was funny. And the Avengers changed a lot. From this here, the Honor Blackman shows, none of them are really done as spoofs. But when the Emma Peel stuff got into it, they had a chemistry. It all turned into a big spoof. And by the new Avengers, it just got really silly. I mean, it got goofball as hell. They brought in this guy they call Mother. Big guy, he was so fat he couldn't really walk. He lived in Artist Loft warehouse or whatever at times. He was always doing, it didn't matter. I mean, you know, he was eating the finest of foods, drinking the finest of booze with the finest of women all around him, and he's not noticed. And from what I understand, it didn't go over so well with the fans. But I like it. It was fun. I mean, I don't know what to say about that. If they had good cuts of it, I would probably want it. But they don't seem to. Because, you know, nowadays they can go back over it digitally and fix all that crap. It almost doesn't matter how bad it is.
Mm.
But I'm sure they see it in a business point of view, there isn't enough money in it to do that. So, yeah.
What the hell is the Avengers?
What are they?
Yeah, what is this?
They're essentially like MI6, MI5, MI6, British, just like, you know, James Bond or what have you. Only they're a team. In fact, all throughout the series, there would be times that they would split off and work separately. Yeah, they were highly trained spies. Mrs. Peel was pretty much the character a lot of people don't, because it was only really explained in the beginning why she was there. But she's really kind of a genius. You know, much smarter than Steve. Very capable. They ended her stint with her husband being found because she was married. I think it was an Air Force colonel or something. I don't really remember. But in the end, he's very much like Steve. Which was fine. I mean, the way they ended it.
Who's Honor Blackman's character?
She was just like a spy.
What's John Steed's deal? Who is he? What is he?
Well, John Steed is actually reserve military. He never... And I think he's a major. In one show, he goes to a reunion because he was RAF. He was like a pilot. In another one, he gets recalled. But come think of it, when he gets recalled, it seems to me he got recalled in the Navy. But I can't swear to it. I do know that he was not retired. He was reserve military.
In the episode we watched, quick overview of it, The Undertakers... The basic premise is that, and it's introduced in sort of a sideways fashion, the scientist that Mr. Steve wants to go to America to ends up being off in a commune somewhere. He's off meditating, retired, basically out of nowhere. He's just no longer accessible. And instead, Steve has to talk to his wife. And the wife is very dismissive of him and kind of sends him on his way, sends him packing. Steed kind of wants to investigate that in part just because it's his job to make sure that the plans for this particular new film gets to a joint meeting between U.S. and British forces in New York because it'll be useful for, I guess, spy trade and the like. Over the course of his investigation and with the help of the Honor Blackman character, they determine that there's a whole slew of millionaires that have gone missing in recent times. Some of them are close friends and associates of the fellow that Steve's supposed to be working with. And it turns out there's apparently a British tax, or a death tax, essentially. And these millionaires' families are trying to work around the death tax by having actors pretend to be those millionaires and have them pretend to still be alive and gift their fortunes within a five-year time frame ahead of their deaths so that they can get the inheritances without being taxed. And a lot of these millionaires are unwillingly ended as part of the scheme. And the people who are killing them are a group of undertakers who actually show up at their abodes with a casket, murder them, stuff them in the casket, and then hire actors to pretend to be them. And they're all staying at the same rest home, commune, meditation center, whatever it happens to be. And so they're slowly uncovering this whole affair. And involves, you know, like secret rooms underneath built into the wall caskets and all kinds of nuttiness. I liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought it was a hoot. I don't have a problem with how staged everything is because it's literally like three or four different locations all cleared on a soundstage. They do some exterior shots late in the show. My understanding is earlier in the series they couldn't afford to do that and wouldn't do that. But I guess the Avengers by the 63 season was popular enough they'd get away with a little of that. But for me, I don't mind it being a stage production because that means the emphasis is on the performances and on the story. And I thought that they did a great job with all of it. They got an American character who's kind of this swaggering dude with sunglasses, and he was fun. All the actresses are great. I especially like, though, the original A Millionaire's Wife, because she's eccentric. She's kind of a crazy person. She's always smiling and speaks very matter-of-factly about things that a wiser person would prudently not reference. She was a blast because she was so great at playing a nut job. And just the visuals were really cool. I like the setup. I like the macabre element to it. I like when you have genres kind of bleed together. And even though this is mostly a British spy story, there's also that element of, you know, like a Vincent Pricey kind of thing going on as well. You even have one guy, the Undertaker himself, had a little bit of a John Carradine look about him. I really liked Honor Blackman's character because she was just a badass. She was doing the martial arts moves, and you see her handling herself with weapons and everything.
Well, and that was, which they brought back with the Peel character. Mm-hmm. With Blackman's character, that was her major talent.
Was the martial arts.
Was the martial arts, yeah.
And I'm sure that that was a huge influence on a lot of characters that came afterwards. Spy characters, comic book characters. I see a lot of Black Widow and Black Canary in just the Honor Black and Alone in her performance. Steed, it was okay. He did a good job in the context of the story, but the characters in this initial exposure to him, a creep. He's very slimy. At the end of the episode, they have an action sequence where they're running around in a hedge, not really even a hedge maze, just like a bunch of hedges with some statues. And there's a bunch of naked women statues, oversized ones. Ultimately, like the characters are climbing up on these statues. Steed's like grabbing the statues, kind of groping them in ways that were very Trumpian. And at the end of the episode, he's talking about, you know, after trying to hit on Honor Blackman's character yet again and being totally rebuffed, he's got like a sweaty lip as he's drinking and talking about those big beautiful women in the hedges, and he just comes off as a total
okay
scumbag.
Well, first off, you gotta remember that this product, you're watching it on a 65-inch screen in HD. It sees things that people couldn't see back then.
Yeah.
I mean, it was made for... The TV sets for in Britain were different than the TV sets in America, but still the same rules apply. You know, in Britain, everything's, for most people, everything's smaller. So most of their TV sets were like 10-inch sets, black and white 10-inch sets. That's what that damn thing is made for. Yeah, you probably couldn't see the sweat, okay?
No, I'm sure you couldn't. You could really see it on the big TV, though.
Really, yes. There's a lot of things you couldn't, because I lived in those times. You know, I've watched the shows that I enjoyed back then, and then I watch them now on a big screen. I'm going, damn, I never saw that crap before. You watch Wild Wild West. I watched Wild Wild West on a 26-inch RCA color TV. Watched it when it was black and white. We had black and white sets in our family till about 1964, 1965. Color was something pretty amazing to us. And when I got out of the service, I think the first TV I bought was a black and white because I couldn't afford a color set. Color sets were expensive. I remember the first one I bought was about a 10-inch RCA portable, which is kind of a funny thing because TV itself was pretty big and pretty heavy, but it had a small screen on it. And I think I paid about $465 for that at Foley's. That was a lot of money. That would be a good weekly pay, and I mean exceptionally good. You know, all through the 70s, that much money was quite a bit of money. A 26-inch set, there's just no comparison to a flat screen. I mean, even a flat screen 30, because you're talking around basically a round picture that's somewhat bowed. And I know you know what I'm talking about. Your grandmother never had really a spectacular TV set that I'm aware of. Her sets were generally of an older nature, preceding a couple of decades by a couple of decades.
Yeah. The nicest TV we had, I think we got it either a Jimco or maybe an electronics store at the mall. And it was one of those ones that was built into a cupboard. How big would that screen?
It was a console, yeah, and she had to get it on time. I remember her talking about she had to get it because that's how she could pay for it.
Like a rent-to-own kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't remember what brand it was. I think I went over there and it was a color set. And I said, oh, wow, you got color. And she told me you know, she was like that. You know, if the subject come up, she was going to discuss it.
Yeah.
And she said that she had to go, it was like a rent-to-buy deal.
Yeah, and how big a screen would you say that was?
I think it was a 19-inch.
Yeah. And but the actual console was about 4 feet, like a
yeah,
really long.
Yeah, because it had a, didn't it have a turntable and stuff in it?
No, I don't think so. I think it was maybe, I don't know. I really don't think so, though.
Yeah,
I just remember it being a great big wooden console, and we watched the television. I think the TV lasted less than a decade. Yeah, I know for a fact it lasted less than a decade, because I remember us first getting it, and also I remember her putting another TV on top of it when that TV went out.
Yeah.
And I think I remember it actually being serviced perhaps in
house. Yeah, I think the one that you're talking about that she got later was like a gold star or something.
And that's what she was watching when she died was that one. So
it seems to me it was a console that, and the first thing to die in it was the turntable and the...
That might have been the case, because whenever we, in the rare instances when we would use a stereo or...
Because it was almost used like a separation between the kitchen area and the living room.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it was against the wall that was where the bar over by the kitchen, that's where we had the stereo that we used. Like, right. I don't even remember the turntable and that ever working, but I never remember using the turntable in the console if it was there in the first place. But I think I have vague recollection that I'd be looking under there one time, but yeah, I don't remember it ever getting used in our house.
Your grandmother really wasn't all that. She wasn't interested in that. She was interested in the TV.
Yeah, yeah, definitely more so. I will say that when we were in London, I did see a lot of naked chick statues, so that was an accurate reflection. I think that if we had more naked chick statues in the U.S. and fewer Confederate generals, we'd be a happier place.
Misogyny was the name of the game back then. And maybe there were some women that didn't like it, but it was an expected thing. And him patting the ass or tweaking the tit of a statue was just humor. A lot of times when you're watching stuff like that, you really gotta put yourself in that time. But then again, also, it's a learning thing. You can understand somebody like Trump or that other jerk that wants to be senator. They were aware of that crap when they were young, you know? And it was, to tell you the truth, it was worse in more rural areas. But, I mean, you know, I can remember a time where it was odd when women worked. Most women, when I was young, aspired to being housewives. No, I don't think they were any happier about it than they are now. You know, the man made the money. The woman took care of the kids in the house. My mother smoked cigarettes, but she hid it from my father, who also smoked.
Things have changed a lot, and they keep on changing. Things are changing from when I was a kid. Or yeah. What was okay, you know, what jokes were funny, what you could get away with.
Look. When you were born and when you were a kid, a common line to get a conversation started with a woman was to call her foxy or call her fine, stuff like that. I never used those lines, by the way. I was more like tell a joke and get them laughing or something, you know. A lot of guys in the 70s, their idea of women's liberation was your place or mine. Me, I just never thought about it. Being brought up in a maternal
matriarchy
type household, a lot of the power players in the family were my great aunts and stuff. They were the ones that knew about finance and business and making money, and just never occurred to me. I was raised to be a gentleman, and as far as I was concerned, you know, the way I saw it, being a gentleman meant you respected women all the way. You know, you didn't. So I never saw myself better than a woman. And I certainly, many of the things that I know took place would never. It's only in retrospect, only as I became an adult, that I realized that my father was a chauvinist. He didn't believe women should have guns. You know, that was a man's thing. Shoot, I was middle-aged before I knew he felt like that. And he was married to a rich, powerful woman. I don't know how that worked, but yeah, he was a chauvinist, and he saw very defined places for men and women.
Well, but he also had a somewhat limited influence on you because he wasn't around a lot.
Yeah, that's true. But the fact was that he had a great deal of influence on telling me about how a gentleman conducts himself. He taught me don't gamble unless you're prepared to lose, which meant don't gamble. And I kind of carried on. Your nephews, whenever I greet them, I call them gentlemen. They always looked at me. They're still look at me like, what the heck? That's the kind of thing that he would do. It just never occurred to me to be anything. And I wasn't always a gentleman. And sometimes you forget because the woman you're with is not like me. But I think I always showed women respect. And I certainly wouldn't have. When I'm talking locker room talk as he put it. I'll talk trash and stuff, but I mean, it's just talk. It certainly doesn't mean anything. I certainly never said that I'd go around grabbing any ass I wanted to.
Well, the last thing I want to touch on, too, is the music. I think the music was extremely important to the show. I'm a big fan of the xylophone. I think xylophones are really underused in modern music especially. And I think they're really great with tension and giving it all off kilter feel, which this episode needed with the Undertakers. But also at the end, the big action sequence where they're in the hedges. You know, if you're just watching it with the sound
It's nothing off, but percussion. Drums, bongos, and congos.
Right. And if you're just watching the visuals, it's just people coming in and out of these hedges and climbing on these statues. It's very stiff. It's not impressive physically. And it reminded me a lot of the kind of stuff a kid would do if they were imagining themselves trying to be spies in the hedges. But because of the music and that percussion and that the tension created by the music, it makes what would have been a pretty lackluster action sequence solid.
I don't know. It just got on my nerves. But the truth of the matter is, TV shows of that era used bongos and percussions quite a bit. Jazz was popular. They used xylophones quite a bit. A lot of white bread jazz. You remember Kenny G?
Yeah.
And all the jokes about his, you know, white bread jazz. At that time, there was a lot of jazz being done on xylophones. I mean, you see it on Ed Sullivan all the time, you know, so.
Well, I think that's part of the problem is you kind of associate that instrument with, like, Lawrence Welk and shit, and it becomes kind of cheesy. So there's certain instruments kind of fall out of favor because of their associations. I'm sure the accordion has had better days, but following its use in variety shows and cornball
well,
stuff,
Lawrence Welk, in truth, was a polka brand. I mean, he played the accordion, you know?
Yeah.
He was an oom-pa-pa guy.
Yeah.
And he was trying to be homogenized. I've watched Lawrence Welk, probably seen every one of them shows.
There's another thing that you started on PBS, as I recall.
Well, but in my time, it was on regular TV. And you probably watched it because there wasn't anything else. He came on Sunday nights at a time when there was nothing else on.
It was definitely a thing that I would channel surf through. You know, you'd see the little bubbles in the air and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah.
Yeah, and it wasn't a show even my parents would normally watch. My mother would go fix dinner when that, because I think it was like Sunday nights. It might have been Saturday night. I don't know. I know my parents didn't really watch that show.
Extra Square.
Yeah. Even in its time, it was geriatric. But he was big. Before, you were talking about J. Edgar Hoover, and we were talking about all this super duper whipped, everybody looking a certain way and dressing a certain way and acting a certain way. Lawrence Welk, I've seen those interviews. He was a taskmaster. Now, some of the people he hired, they struggled mentally. They had their own trials like any show business people would. But they hid that crap from him because he would just can them. He couldn't have any kind of controversy. His people were all wholesome, next-door neighbor, you want to marry into that family people. That's how he wanted himself to be presented. But I hate accordions. I hate accordions. I can only stomach so much Zydeco. Polka accordion? Man, that goes right to my nervous system. I want to get a gun and shoot somebody.
I've heard the occasional effective use of an accordion, but mostly I just relate it to Weird Al and his polka covers of popular songs and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and Tejano is polka music. Yeah. I'm sorry. You can call it whatever you want to, but it's polka. And it makes perfect sense because there was a time in Mexico where the upper crust of Mexico were, it was like calling them disco. They were called polkas. You know, so it makes perfect sense. But I'm more of a mariachi guy. I love mariachi.
I like my initial taste of Avengers. I'm going to try to see if I can catch up on some of the earlier material or maybe catch a little bit of stuff on my own. And then we'll come back and talk about them some more in the future.
Okay, well, we're going to do a peel thing too, so, but not at this very moment.
Yeah. You don't look like you're doing much of anything beyond the next couple of minutes.
No, I'm surprised when we started this, discussion. I really thought when that show ended, I was about ready to die right there, but I guess I got a second wind or something.
Well, you didn't nap through like half of the episode, too, so that probably helped. You got like a good half hour in the midst of it.
If you say so.
Yeah, you were asleep. You were snoring.
Okay.
You only woke up when I went to pause it 10 minutes before the episode ended.
No, I was awake when you walked up from behind me. I was sitting there watching it, so... The mail.
Yeah, I was going to have you read the mail. They get tired of my voice, I'm sure. It'd be good to hear somebody else do it. You just got to read the names of our social media agents who are helping to promote bonding agents.
The 108th Sage, Adam Blackmoon, Allie Batts, Annie Freaks, Dash Annie Nostalgia, Dr. Ange, Anthony the Insomniac, Drunken Monk of Altima Fans, Batman and Popular Culture Conference, Binko DeJano, Bob Buster, Chris at Bat Brooks for Beginners, Chronosphere Fiction, The Sinbad Podcast, Clinton Robinson. Oh, Coffee and Comics, Comics in the Golden Age, Daniel French, Fish Bonus, Sound Design, David Golding Art, Dog Days, Devin Dark Web, Felix Leader, Derek William Crabb, Doc Strange, Dr. G, the Man of Nerdology, Dwight L. McPherson, Epsilon, Philip Alves D.O., Gabriel Blake, Gord Tolton, The Hammer, Gabriel Blake, Gord Tolton, Gregory Lynchfield, The Hammer Strikes, Ransom Geeky Stuff, History of Comic on Film, The Hoopers, Ice in the Face, Jeffrey Brown, Jennifer DeRoss, Jerry McMullen, Jerry Whitworth, Joe Crawford, John Horsley, Justice First Dawn, Keith G. Baker, Christanos, Kyle Benning Likes Comics, Leslie C. Gonzalez, Longbox Crusade, Longbox of Darkness, Martin Gray, Max Romero, Mount Leecha, Sacrificial Dark, Myrna Loy, The Nerd Range Podcast, Nerd Feet Strangers, Nexus of All, Nicole, Paul Matthew Carr, Professor Frenzy, Randomitable, I don't know, man, Randy Andrews, Randy Caldwell, The Relative Geeky Podcast Network, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Resurrection, and Adam Warlock, and Thanos Podcasts, Richard G., Ryan Daly, Cheers Cast, Scott X., Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Sean Merrick, Siskoid, Slangword Scott, Steve Sellers, Talk Nerdy to Me, Tim Price, Tony, Varangian Vigilante?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you say so, Warlock Worlds, Webcast 411, Words and Pictures, Zach Sally.
We got a comments from both Daniel French and Chronosphere Fiction featuring a James Bond video game death animation where they show the opening target sequence, and instead of Bond turning and shooting you, Bond gets shot and like spirals into death. So for some reason, they both sent us that animation.
Secret Worlds and Beyond Podcast wrote, totally listening to this on my flight home. You told me about that one. Gord Tolton wrote, incredible show. Another piece of puzzle emerges. Thanks. Martin Gray wrote, so old dude, is Diablo Baloo Dad?
Yeah, Diablo Dad, my little handle.
Oh, okay. Oh, we need a dad and son pick. Devlin Darkweb, Felix Leiter.
You got to say Felix Leiter because that's from Bond. Okay, Delvin right. actually runs his own podcast.
The cat and the bad light, what do you want?
I was just saying, he's got a group of podcasts he works with, and they do On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast, I think it's called, where they cover the James Bond movies. Uh-huh. So they're another group that basically were doing the same stuff we were going to do, so we changed course a little bit.
Welcome back, gents. Cigar Goyle wrote Derek Flint for life.
Cigar Goyle sounds like somebody
after you. Is that a reference to us talking about Flint?
Because I did the Zero episode, which was basically just us bullshitting and talking crazy shit. Then the first episode, we covered Our Man Flint. Our Man Flint is the first one or In Like Flint?
No, Our Man.
Our Man Flint was
the first one.
So, yeah. So, we covered that on the first proper episode of Bonnie Agents. So, yep, that's everything then.
Okie dokie. Secret.